This episode is sponsored by The Mass Factor, the online platform from learning company Pearson. This engaging educational platform, created by Carol Vorderman, helps your child master years 1 to 7 math topics.
It's matched to the national curriculum, caters to all abilities, and helps reinforce the message that maths is the key to unlocking a lifetime love of learning and confidence. 90% of parents see an improvement in their child's confidence within 3 months of using the Maths Factor.
Now, on with the show.
You're listening to the NetMums podcast with me, Wendy Gollidge.
And me, Jennifer Howes. On this week's show...
Who really needs to know the answers to quadratic equations? You don't. So I would always argue that there should be 2 GCSEs.
But before all of that... Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode. Jen and I have been discussing this morning. Jen is wrapped up like she's in the bloody Arctic this morning because she's refusing to put her heating on. And I have caved. My husband's away, which might also be why I've caved, and put the heating on. So it's really warm in here. I'm feeling like I might take a layer off. And we decided that heating has become the new weather conversation in Britain this autumn, winter. Have you put your heating on yet? So, Jen, you haven't put your heating on yet.
I haven't. That's why I'm bundled up. But our guest doesn't appear to be too cold, even though she's very cool.
Oh, cha-ching, get you.
Our guest this week is none other than Carol Vorderman, MBE. Famed for co-hosting Countdown for 26 years, she is an entrepreneur, philanthropist, best-selling author, and a pilot. Carol is a champion of all things maths and as such has created the Maths Factor. Working with Pearson, the learning company, the Maths Factor website is designed to kickstart a love of maths and help children master years 1 to 7 maths topics. So welcome, Carol.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to meet you. And I'm not sure if my heating's on or not. You know, I've been a great proponent of insulate. All my life, and you know, I'm so old, I've lived in various houses, and it's the first thing I do. Walls, floors, ceilings, everywhere I can insulate, I do. So I sort of live in this strange cocooned thing. I'm forever opening windows. So.
Right, Carol, you know what I'm going to ask you about. My husband has more maths qualifications than I can count. My 11-year-old loves it, and quite frankly, maths scares me witless. It's always been like my weak link. Talk to me about maths. How can the Maths Factor help kids like me who were just scared of maths? Oh, actually, I'm 44 and I'm still bloody scared of maths, in truth.
It's interesting that you say that because, you know, I have worked in this maths education field for a long, long time. And the Maths Factor has been running for 12 years. That's my online school. I've been writing and promoting maths books with Dorling Kindersley, with DK, for 25, 30 years. And obviously, yeah, for 40 years now, can you believe 40 years, November the 2nd, being on the telly talking about maths and actually doing it. So I think I have a pretty unique position because people have spoken to me about their, what's called maths phobia now, for a very long time. I wrote and chaired a report for David Cameron. I'm not a Tory, I'm not in anything.
She said that very quickly, did you notice?
I'm a pragmatic woman who, if the current Prime Minister, I did a lot of work with David Blunkett, for instance, about online grooming of children, Labour Party. So I say that so that this is not politically motivated, but I spent 2 years of my life chairing this task force, which was looking into maths aged 5 to 19 across our education system. And to answer your question, the one thing that we found on a factual basis was that if a child gets maths phobia, and it's generally because they aren't taught very well, by the age of 11, it is very rare to resolve that. So the facts are 96% of primary school teachers gave up maths at the age of 16. And they gave up maths simply because either they weren't taught well, they found it difficult, they weren't particularly interested in the subject. So what happens is, and again, this is factual, the SATs results, age 11, if you got above the government target at age 11, and then we could translate it to 5 years later when they took their GCSEs. So this is all statistics, which we did for the report. So if you got above the government target by age 11, you would more or less be guaranteed to get your GCSE maths. If you achieve the government target, which then was level 4B, around about half would get their GCSE at age 16. But if you were below by the age of 11, almost all failed their GCSE. So secondary school may have added information, but it did not take one child out of this anxiety or poor relationship with numbers and poor relationship with the language of mathematics. And that's something which, you know, is very, very dear to my heart. And it's my passion and has always been my passion.
I mean, that is a, by age 11, kids either get it and love it, or at least like it, or they don't.
I've got an 11-year-old. She likes maths, actually. Interestingly, she loves maths.
So if she likes maths, she is likely now to do well.
But I didn't like maths and I found it very hard. And so I understand what you're saying, because essentially you go to secondary school and they're building on a foundation that you don't have. So they start adding more and more complicated maths. But if you don't understand the basics, which I didn't, it's terrifying. And you're so right. Then the language, so much of maths is understanding the bloody question in the first place.
Yeah, I think too, it's this idea of being confident. Like, I always think of myself as being good at maths. I don't know, but I've always been somebody kind of in the arts, a writer, etc. And I don't know that I'm actually better at maths than a lot of other people kind of in my field. But because I've always thought, yeah, I'm good at maths, that even when I'm confronted with a problem, I think, oh, I can figure it out. I can work it through. And even it's just that idea that I wonder, Wendy, if there are people like you who think, oh, I'm not good at maths, it scares me. They're not good at it. It's just that feeling they have, right?
This is. And I'm in all walks of life, whether you talk about relationships or anything, I think the thing that people forget is, where do you live? You know, if you ask somebody, where do you live? Oh, I live in Bristol. You live in London or wherever. But it's, you actually live in your head. The only sense of anything that you have is in your mind. So if you are confident about something, you believe it, and therefore you live it. So it's exactly what you're saying, which is that confidence. If people go, can you cook? I go, I'm great. Do you know what? I am an amazing cook. I'm not. But if I say it with confidence, then they go, oh, yes, this is really nice if I cook them something, because I've convinced them. It's a bit of a sales talk to myself, I think. Yes, I am. But the confidence with maths comes from this early age, and it's something that, you know, we have, oh God, hundreds and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of pieces of evidence with children where we have taken them. My son was a special needs child, special educational needs child. So, and my daughter has just got a PhD from Cambridge in nanotechnology. So you can see the difference in, you know, this girl was like, oh, great, mum, I'm going to be doing my maths. Oh, you know, from the age of four, my son, very different. So I learned how to teach strugglers, and that is fundamentally, and give them confidence, fundamentally what we do on the maths factor. Kids who love maths do exceptionally well. But to me, the very special ones are the ones who've struggled. Some of them autistic, some of them just strugglers, some of them not being taught particularly clearly in school. And they get that moment when they say, oh, I got it. And their confidence, we have all the data, you know, and 90-something% of parents who've had children on the maths factor say that the confidence in their child grows within a couple of months of working with me magnificently. But here's what happens is, it's not just confidence in maths. So everyone says to a child, young child, oh, maths is hard. That's basically what's pushed out there. So they think, oh, maths is hard. And they start to, you know, physically go into themselves. And then when they get the answer to something and they understand it, their confidence grows in class to the point where a lot of our kids become top of the class. And then they're confident. They are now the best or one of the best at the hardest subject. So now their confidence in life grows. And we can see it, you know, and they send us videos and all sorts of different things. And we can see it also because we're an online school. We see it in their results of, you know, their percentage that they get right in every little homework, as we call them, that they do with us. So it's factual. It's a fact. And it's about that clarity, really, absolute clarity of learning and teaching.
So how can parents make maths more accessible and fun at home? I mean, obviously, they can go on and use something like the Maths Factor. Overall, what can we do to just really make our kids love or even just, you know, feel like, yeah, maths?
I think the key, the thing that is really the one thing you must not do is say, maths is hard. Oh, I hate maths. Those are the two things. Sorry, Wendy, I'm not looking at you particularly. Have you ever said that to your children, Wendy?
No. I've got a husband who's got two maths A levels and did a maths degree. Maths is like loved in my house. I just keep that. But everybody does say, oh, mummy's rubbish at maths. But if there's maths homework to be done, it's definitely daddy who gets asked. But I've never said it's hard. Yeah. I've said mummy finds it hard, but I haven't said it's hard. But that is a really useful takeaway for parents. Don't tell your kids that maths is hard.
Never. Because it's what the media tells them all the time. It's what telly tells them. It's what, you know, even, you know, competent and very well-respected news journalists say. Because it's a thing to say. It's meant to sound clever in some way. Oh, I'm rubbish at maths, you know. Why are you saying that? You're patently not. Or if you are presenting the Today programme on Radio 4, then you shouldn't be if you say you don't understand percentages because you're interviewing chancellors and ministers, you know. So it's a strange relationship in the terms of the language that's used that our country has with maths.
Yeah, and the thing is, maths, as you just pointed out, maths is everywhere. You know, do you like sports and do you like to keep the stats of your favorite sports stars? You know, do you like cooking? Do you like, you know, music? Like all those things.
Exactly, it's everywhere. Numbers.
Numbers, but in a good way.
Yeah, and one of the things I have argued for years is this, there is, you know, mathematics is a bigger subject than numbers. But for most people, but the vast majority of people only need number work, to be honest. But the maths curriculum is put together, and history curriculum and many more, but maths particularly, and you'll understand this, Wendy, and your husband will, it starts with what does a maths graduate or an engineering graduate at a fine university need to have in their knowledge bank in mathematics in order to go to that university. This is how curricula are set. So from that, what then do we have to put into the A-level curriculum? So you're talking about this like 4%, 5%, even less and something. So then what do they need to do for their GCSE in order to go on to study A-level maths or A-level further maths in order to go on to university to be a physicist or whatever it might be? And my argument is that the vast majority of people need never touch trigonometry other than as a little interesting little module. Algebra to a level is quite interesting, but who really needs to know the answers to quadratic equations? You don't. So I would always argue that there should be two GCSEs. Others would argue against me, and it's the academics who argue against me on this. But I would rather that, you know, someone who's struggling with numbers has clarity in their teaching, clarity in the curriculum, rather than struggling and failing with stuff that they will never, ever, 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 ever in their lives use again.
Maths can unlock not just a lifetime of learning. It can set your child on the road to a career as an astronaut, engineer, or maths genius like the founder of the Maths Factor, Carol Vorderman.
On the Maths Factor online platform, kids get weekly maths lessons and guidance from Auntie Carol, exploring topics for year one through to year seven pupils with a suite of video tutorials, interactive games, and fun challenges.
Check out the Maths Factor to get your child learning and loving maths today. Now, back to the show.
So do you have any other little takeaways for parents? Don't say maths is hard, number one. Anything else for parents who, like me, have had a strange relationship with maths? How can they not pass that on to their kids? And what can they do if they're, other than signing up to the Maths Factor and talking to Auntie Carol, what else can they do to kind of help kids love maths or at least not be scared of maths?
I think it's in the practice. I think if you are struggling yourself, there is a way maybe of on a book or on a YouTube video or something to say, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to learn it with you. So rather than say, oh, it's hard and I can't do it. So, you know, there are a lot of free materials. We have a lot of free materials on the Maths Factor where you can sit and you can watch together. And a lot of parents have appreciated that. If you don't want to go on the Maths Factor, then there's something else, you know, but there's a lot that's free there. And learn it together, whether it's from their little textbook or the sheets that they're sent to go home, rather than you just do your homework because the parent is frightened of the subject. You're starting that. But also, don't be afraid to ask what you think are stupid questions. No question is stupid. If a child does not understand and says, I do not understand, the child is not stupid. The teacher is not teaching properly. So it is important for every child that no question, and please say this to your children, no question is a stupid question. Failure is if I, as a teacher, can't give you an answer. And that is a whole different way of looking at educating and learning. And it's a critically important one. And I know I say that, you know, from all the tears that I've cried when my son was young. And, you know, it was, oh, he's stupid. Well, he hasn't. He's just got a master's degree from Dundee University. It was just that the ways of teaching him needed to be adapted. You know, that's something that we concentrate on. So there are different, obviously with my subject, with numbers, you know, you have children like my daughter who's like I was, you know, oh, I get it. You know, they always get 100%, 98%, and they're just racing against time. It's just a speed exercise for them. And then you get those right at the lower end who need different levels of explanation. And then you get the vast majority, you know, in the middle who can't go as fast as the ones at the top and so on. But any decent teacher should be able to explain to the child who is struggling and to take it down a level to them, to really understand where their problem is. And that's what we do, because if they don't get, you know, 70% in their test or something, we go, well, you've done really, Auntie Carol comes up, you know, you've done really, really, really well. And I am so proud of you. So your next lesson with Auntie Carol is going to be about, and they don't know, but I'm taking it into another depth of understanding for them so that then they come out the next test, they get 95 out of 100. So it's, and then they can print out certificates after every test. And then, you know, they have their whole walls are covered in their certificates of how much maths they've done and how well they've done. And then they start to believe. Back to what I was saying, that confidence. If you believe you can, like you were saying, Jen, you know, you believe you can do maths.
I can figure it out.
It's that, I think, is the other takeaway, is to say to a child, no question is a stupid question and no child is stupid. I know factually that the kids who come on with us all do well. And that's been going 12 years now.
The sense of kids being rejected, you know, by the school, by teachers, by other pupils, you know, you've spoken about how heartbreaking and difficult that is as a parent. And you've talked a little bit about how you encourage in the teaching, but how do you encourage a child academically when they don't kind of fit the mold, or they're not getting that positive feedback on their efforts at school? How do you deal with that as a parent?
I think if they have special educational needs, as my son did, he was off the scale dyslexic, and so he was in a special school for about 4 or 5 years in the end, because I found that I didn't have the knowledge base I'm a good teacher, but I didn't have the knowledge base of how to teach a special educational needs child. And sadly, in the UK, there isn't much support for them. Budgets have been cut in local authorities for the support that, you know, they tend to have a unit of teachers and helpers who would then go into schools once the child has been validated as having special educational needs. Some people are waiting years for that educational psychiatrist test. It's not a good place at all at the moment.
We may see that kind of getting worse if there are further cuts that the government's talking about.
Yes, I can only see it getting worse right now, because they end up as the forgotten ones. But the sad thing is, and I'm desperate to do a documentary about it on the telly to highlight it, is that a massive percentage, and the majority of those in young offenders institutes, are severely dyslexic, you know, and yet you also have 40% of self-made millionaires who are also dyslexic. So there's a point at which they go one way or the other. So for an entrepreneur, you would say, what does that entrepreneur? Well, they have to have a unique view on life. They have to, you know, they fit every little box that's said there. And yet, you know, in the Young Offenders Institutes, I saw my boy, who is like remarkable. Of course, I'd say that because I'm his mum. He's 25 now and we live together. He is the kindest, most centered young person I think I've ever come across. And he was bullied at school and all of those things. But I remember when he was 5, when these issues were coming to light, because, of course, all the kids are being taught how to read in class. And he was as good as gold. Both of my kids have been as good as gold at home. And yet he was being thrown out of the classroom. And at the end of one term, the head teacher said, I just can't accept him in this school anymore. Why? Because he's fighting and he's doing this and he's doing that. So here's this lovely kid who is trying his best to distract others, because everything on the page is physically jumping round in his eyes. And there are some incredible memes and pieces now which explain it to the likes of us who aren't dyslexic, what that looks like. There's one that he showed me, and there's a little paragraph of a few sentences, and we go on it and the letters are always jumbling around. We're like, well, I can't, oh, good grief, I can't read it. And then you hit stop and it comes to what you and I would read. And then you think, God, I didn't realise that. And then there are all the issues of ADD or ADHD, and should, you know, children take Ritalin or Ritalin equivalent, which my son has done since he was 6 or 7. No side effects other than he's able to concentrate and not fall asleep. You know, there are lots and lots of issues, I think, there that you need specialists in that area when their learning difficulties are so bad. And I think we're wasting massive potential of young people who see the world differently. I spend my life giving back to education, giving bursaries to kids, doing reports, encouraging children from state schools. I was a free school meals kid, to apply to some of the finer universities. And that's a big part, which is never written about in the papers.
Doesn't make a great headline, Carol. Of course it's not. Well, you've segued very nicely into the next thing I was going to ask you about, which does make a great headline, which is all the ageist claptrap that you have to put up with. You recently got told, I quote, to act
tracked your age after trying to learn to do the splits, which I want to know if you can do, by the way. But how do you navigate this sort of nonsense?
Well, the thing is, I've always had to. So when I was, not my mother or my grandmother, was 39 in the 21st century, year 2000, I went to the BAFTAs and I wore a short dress, not a micro skirt.
How dare you?
I know. They made a Kilroy show on the BBC and they flew this dress in from Paris. It was an Angaro dress, beautiful dress, from Paris. And this huge debate in the studio was not, is this a nice dress? The debate was, should a woman aged 39 wear a dress above the knee?
I mean.
Well, exactly. Exactly. So it's, but, oh, the vitriol was extraordinary.
Carol, how very dare you?
Get your knees out, woman. Come on.
I am a very free thinker. So I don't judge people. If that's your thing and you're not harming anybody, that, you know, that's your thing. So I've always rebelled. I've had to
but
get a life.
That's not rebellion. And... that's just wearing a frock. That's not...
I know. So then we move on. But here's the interesting thing to me. So bearing in mind that all the other women around the age of 40 at that time were brought up as I was, which was, we were told to get married, you know, as soon as possible. And we were told, and I'm not against that, if that's what people choose to do. But we were told you should marry a man who's going to look after you. You should do all of these things. So it was always, and you should play safe, always the woman was, you should play safe, you should do that. We go on 20 years, the vast majority of women work. You know, they either choose to work because they want to, or they have to work for financial reasons or a little bit of both. So now you've got women with financial freedom and so on. And so it's now, it's like these younger generations, I would say you two are of a younger generation and the generation beneath, they are supportive of what I do, if that makes sense. So now it's like vast majority of opinions are supportive. So anyone who goes, oh, act your age, what is that meant to be? Society's rules change consistently. So what does act your age actually mean? Because then if you get to 70 and you're doing the splits, oh, good on her. You know, it's like, oh, is there this strange period of time?
Where's the crossover? And can you do the splits yet? Come on.
Well, I'm getting there, girls. So one of the things is, as you get a little bit older and you're post-menopause, is that, you know, you start to get a little creak here and there and so on. And I've always been pretty healthy and I enjoy good health. In other words, I have good health and I use that good health. So I love hiking and I go paddleboarding and I do all sorts of different things. I had a fall when I was hiking and my knee was a bit, and I just thought, oh, I'm getting a bit, ooh, 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 and I don't like that. So I can only really work with targets. So I have to have a challenge. So if you said to me, oh, I wake up in the morning and I bloody hate yoga. It's just boring. And I've tried it, but it's dull. And so I'm not that person, right? So I like a challenge. So my challenge for flexibility is to be able to do the splits. And there's this Eastern European guy, whose name I can't pronounce, and I've paid 10 quid for his lessons. And he's obviously doing it in a flat where he's only got a stool with three legs. That's all you need. And it was the picture of, this isn't like all done to music and all lovely. This is like your basic stuff. And there's a picture of this woman who must be in her 90s doing the front splits with a head on the knee. And I thought, yeah, she'll do for me. And it's good. And it's literally just keeping on doing it. And so I start my stretching because I only do the bits that I like. First thing in the morning, I touch my toes and I see how far I can either get down or can I get my hands on the floor or whatever it is. That's like my basis. Then I do my 20 minutes of the bits that I choose to do. And then I try and touch my toes again. Again, it's like I like markers. I like data.
Look, she's even managed to get maths into doing the splits, Jen.
I know.
I love it. It's great.
So I was that far away from the floor on the front split. Now I'm like 3 inches or so. I need a new party trip, girls. That's the thing.
We need something to get in the sun over, surely. The mail.
I have to say, so I mean, you talk very positively about being health conscious, physical health, mental health. I like these tips because also as a mom, as a fellow single mom, I'm always like trying to make sure I have time to look after my health. So I like this, you know, only like work with targets. Do something that you like.
Or the bits that you like. Pick out the bits that you like.
Yeah, pick out the bits that you like.
And also, because women are never told this, be a bit selfish. Or what we are told is selfish. It's not selfish at all. It's just it's been ingrained into women's heads that looking after yourself a bit or having a bit of time for me is selfish. It's not. But if that's how you do it, then be a bit more selfish. You know, it because the actions that women, and we're just talking about women now, do as regards their health in their 40s, leading on to the menopausal years, is critical. And I've post-menopause maybe five, so I'm 62 in December, and I've seen the difference between someone who has looked after their health and one who hasn't grows in the 50s. You start to see it, you know, dramatically, where people, and a lot of it is what you eat, vast majority is what you eat. But there's some very interesting science now about cellular renewal and these zombie cells, as they're called, these senescent cells, which build up in your body, and how to get rid of them and to give you energy. And the one thing, so I've been a great proponent, as you know, of, you know, bioidentical hormones to get me through the menopause. And post-menopause, it's thyroid. I was getting very, very sluggish.
Well, I've got an underactive thyroid, so...
Well, then you know.
I know. But I've had an underactive thyroid, just small segue for anyone out there. I was diagnosed with an underactive thyroid after I'd had multiple miscarriages.
So your hormones were all over.
So my hormones were all over the place. And it was only when in England... you have to have three miscarriages before anyone really does anything. Let's not go down that rabbit hole right now. But they did blood tests and discovered I had an underactive thyroid. And I can now tell when my levels have changed and I have to go and get tested for different drugs. So it's really interesting. So once I hit the menopause, clearly I'm going to have to change my drugs. This is interesting.
Yeah, I find it fascinating because people say, oh, I have to go to my doctor to have a blood test. Now, obviously, if money, you know, is an issue, there are lots now. I use a company, and I don't promote them or anything. I'm just telling you what I do, called medichecks.com. And they, you know, if you spend an extra 20 quid or something, they'll send a nurse around to take the bloods for you, and you get these fantastic reports. So I, because I'm fascinated by good health and how the science has come round over the last 20 years, particularly the last 10. And so I've kept a record of where my hormones are and so on. Every 6 months I have one of their tests. And it's brilliant because they give you the graphs. Again, we're back to maths, but they give you the graphs of how it's varying. Sorry. And then I was fine. I was so tired. And my weight, I know what my weight should be depending on what I eat, based on how it was in my 40s and my early 50s. It's very different post-menopause. So I thought, well, I can't understand this. I just can't lose the bloat. And, la, 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 and I'm tired. And is this what old age is? I thought, no, bugger that. Let's have a look at the science. So with thyroid, you know, there are the three hormones and so on. So I'm just talking about one, the main one, the thyroxine. So there's a band where you, Wendy, are in the red band. So you have an underactive hypothyroid. And then there's this massive green band above which is another red band, which is hyperthyroidism. So the NHS would say if I was at the bottom of the band, but I wasn't critical, so they'd say, oh, no, you're fine. Well, I'm sorry, I wasn't fine. Now, that might be fine for someone who's 35. And most of the clinical trials, by the way, are done on men, not on women. So I found myself a private doctor, and she, who was what's called a functional medicine doctor, So they're about health, not illness. And she went, no, I'll put you on the thyroxine. I am buzzing, I tell you. And I'm back to where I normally am. I'm eating well and I'm back to the size I like to be. And, you know, and the energy is unbelievable, off the scale. And it's fantastic because it gives you your confidence back. And you think, no, it's not. You know, if I'm going to take, you know, estrogel or testosterone, all those things, you're just taking hormones because the body at some point, why wouldn't I take a thyroid hormone? And so those are the things that people don't talk about. And I think a lot of aging is that we're not looking at the hormones enough for men and women.
It's really interesting. And especially, I think, for, you know, the NetMoms audience, we're often, you know, we think about the beginning of the kind of hormonal journey with trying to conceive and pregnancy, and we don't necessarily think as much the later part of that hormonal journey, you know, often because that's when our children are also, you know, becoming young adults. And so we're really focused on them. I have a friend who does a lot of health writing, and I was having lots of problems with joints and whatnot all of a sudden. And basically, she's like, yeah, motion is lotion. You gotta move every single day.
I like that. Motion is lotion.
And actually, after seeing lots of doctors about this, that, and the other, suddenly it's like, well, if I exercise and work out and do some amount of kind of what we think of as physio every day, there's such a difference.
And a lot of us, you know, if we run up and down the stairs all day, that is also motion. But sitting watching the telly for 6 hours, which I do occasionally when I'm shattered, you know, and back from a week's work, you get up and you're like, you know.
You make the sound sitting down and getting up, oof.
The oof sound. Right, Carol, I was just going to say, before we let you go, I have to take you back to your dim and distant past and talk to you about Countdown. Where it all began. It's a national treasure. Was it as fun as it looked?
Yeah, with Richard it was, yeah. So we started 40 years ago, November the 2nd, 1982.
And I was four.
You were four. There you go. 40 years ago. And it was a huge show. And I hadn't applied for the job, but my mum had written a letter to the producer and forged my signature. That's how I got on. So that's where it started. And then we laughed and laughed and laughed. And then eventually sort of co-hosted it, if you like, because I was only answering the numbers game every other day to start with. So, and Countdown grew. And then this love for Countdown really grew. So it's Channel 4's biggest show for about 15 years before, you know, it beat all of their evening programs and everything. There was just a love for it. And I think with Richard and I, we loved Countdown. It was a living thing for us because, and we never called people who watched Countdown viewers. They were Countdowners because we were all in this family together, you know, this ridiculous family of Countdowners. We happened to be on screen where we just take the mick out of each other all the time. And they would take the mick out of us, and we loved it. And you know, and it was a thing. It was a living thing, and it wasn't a pretense in any way. So when Richard died very, very suddenly, that was I think that's the greatest amount of grief I've ever had in my life, because it was very sudden.
Well, I feel like we're ending on a sad bit now, and it's been so happy.
Well, I don't think no. I mean, obviously, it's tragic that he died so. So young. He was 61, the age I am now, when he died. And he left the party too soon, and he was a party animal and was utterly ridiculous. And I absolutely loved it. Even on the days when we weren't in studio, he would be in my life because every person I saw talked to me about him. What's that Richard Whiteley really like? And, you know, and all of these things. So life is a series of chapters, and some of them are very happy, and just because they end doesn't negate how happy they were. So that was happy, 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 happy. and I was a, it was a great privilege to work on it. Yeah, yeah, old Countdown, as I call it.
Carol, what a lovely way to spend a day chatting.
Yeah, well, thank you for putting up with my very long answers, because I know I bang on about
we
things,
have a long answer. That's all good.
And it's you know, and thank you to everybody for listening, because, you know, there are different ways of looking at life, and no question is a stupid question.
Not even when Wendy and I ask it, so that's good news.
No, well, no question sure. is.
Thank you, Carol, and let us know when you can do the splits, please.
Believe me, the world will know once I manage it. Because I'll never be able to get up again. That's the problem.
And here lies Carol Vorderman
in the splits.
And on that note, ladies and gents, we're going to go and have a cup of coffee. Thank you for joining us, Carol.
Thank you, girls. Thank you.